on us. Aren't we the ones who should be arrogantly oppressing countries that unaccountably do not have the death penalty? And now, as America goes about building support for an attack on Iraq, guess who's complaining again? The turtlenecked chickens are terrified of offending fanatical Muslims. Meanwhile, we are asking Arab leaders to face down the vastly larger populations of crazies living in their countries. While France whines, predominantly Muslim Turkey is preparing its airstrips for a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. If this is a war against terrorism and not a Eurocentric war against Islam, the conclusion is ineluctable. We must attack France. What are they going to do? Fight us? May I turn down your bed, Mohammed? February 1st, 2002. In the event of a surprise attack by North Korea, Secretary of State Colin Powell urged President Bush to ensure that the Office of Homeland Security have full resources and authority to respond to any anti-Korean hate crimes at home. Since you can't tell these days, that's a joke. Powell's real beef concerns the technical procedure by which the United States concludes that the terrorists held at Guantanamo are not prisoners of war. Also, Korean Americans are great Americans and would be the last people to whine about ethnic profiling. What Powell really says is that we should apply the Geneva Convention to the Guantanamo detainees. As he admits, under the convention, the detainees are not prisoners of war, inasmuch as they masquerade as civilians, stage sneak attacks, slaughter innocent civilians, pretend they are surrendering before they come out shooting, take hostages, hide arms in mosques, and generally do not abide by the laws or customs of war. Other administration officials have concluded that the Geneva Convention doesn't apply in the first place, because the detainees masquerade as civilians, stage sneak attacks, slaughter innocent civilians, pretend they are surrendering, etc., etc. The subtle distinction is this. If I showed up at the Super Bowl this Sunday demanding to play for the Patriots, I would be turned away on the grounds that I am not within the definition of people known as the Patriots. Powell's argument is that we should appease our completely useless allies by playing a make-believe game that I am a Patriot. Then the Patriots would make a painstaking finding of fact that I am a scrawny 99-pound weakling and, on the basis of that finding alone, conclude that I cannot play in the Super Bowl. Either the Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters are not covered by the Geneva Convention, or they are but still do not qualify for prisoner of war status. So the main problem with Powell's position is that it lacks what we used to call a point. What determines whether the Geneva Convention applies in the first place is whether we are at war with a signatory nation to the convention. To be sure, some decades ago, a different government of Afghanistan played for the Patriots. That is, was a signatory to the Geneva Convention. But we are not at war with Afghanistan. To the contrary, we are Afghanistan's biggest best buddy in the whole world right now. Though they seem to think the name of our country is the Pentagon. We are at war with Al-Qaeda. The 158 Guantanamo detainees come from at least 25 different countries. To pretend that the Taliban is bound by a convention signed by an earlier Afghan government because the Al-Qaeda fighters happen to have been captured in Afghanistan would be like trying to collect a bill from a family that bought your debtor's house, raised it, and happened to occupy the same property 20 years later. The most popular argument for the Powell view is that we have to be nice to the detainees because otherwise people won't be nice to captured American soldiers. Who are we trying to impress by this largesse exactly? I promise you, any Americans captured by Al-Qaeda will be tortured, disemboweled, and beheaded right before the traditional dancing on the American corpse begins. Indeed, it is difficult to conceive of the United States actually going to war against any country that would honor the Geneva Convention. Despite the enormous groundswell of support for an attack on France, for example, we probably won't invade France. The only people America ever goes to war against are utter savages. In World War II, the Japanese tortured American prisoners of war. In the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese tortured American prisoners of war. In the Gulf War, Iraq tortured U.S. prisoners of war. including a female officer who was sexually assaulted by her captors. So this Geneva Convention thing isn't really working out for us. The argument boils down to the claim that we have to treat the detainees the way human rights nicks say we should in order to secure the approval of human rights nicks. Even the late Justice William J. Brennan had more imaginative arguments than that. Thus far in the war on terrorism, human rights organizations have complained about the detention of terrorism suspects, military tribunals for terrorists, a trial for John Walker, and non-existent ethnic profiling at airports. No one in America cares. It must be galling to the UN Human Rights Commissioner. But for some reason, the human rights organizations imagined that we would be impressed with their complaining about Guantanamo. The country is just shrugging that off, too. Afraid of seeming impotent and irrelevant, even Tony Blair immediately backed down from his criticisms of Guantanamo. Whether Muslim terrorists in Guantanamo are getting enough Fruit Loops is not where the country is right now. We're too busy worrying about averting any potential hate crimes against Muslims. Build Them Back, June 7, 2002. Since September 11th, we have been authoritatively informed that skyscrapers as tall as the World Trade Center will never be built again. A consensus quickly emerged among city officials to replace the soaring twin towers with some potty little buildings in a park. But then, at a meeting to discuss the future of the site last week, hundreds of New Yorkers showed up and shocked the experts by demanding that the towers be rebuilt. One man who had worked on the 77th floor of one World Trade Center said, "Please do not diminish the memory of all the people who died there by building 50, 60, or 70-story mediocre buildings on the site. A little grassy park where people go to weep does lack something in the way of defiance. Instead of us crying, evidently many Americans feel there should be a lot of Arabs crying. The reason liberals prefer a park to luminous skyscrapers is that they are not angry. Liberals express sympathy for the victims, but they're not angry. Instead of longing to crush and humiliate the enemy, they believe true patriotism consists of redoubled efforts to expand the welfare state." Senator Hillary Clinton proposed a school for the World Trade Center site, and Senator Charles Schumer a park. Yeah, that'll show 'em. Meanwhile, the construction workers clearing away the rubble vowed they would work without pay to rebuild the World Trade Center. Of course, now that we have 14 cows, that shouldn't be necessary. In a genuinely touching story, a tiny cow-herding village in Kenya only recently got word of the attack on America, and this week made a special present of 14 cows to the United States. The attack on the World Trade Center ripped America's soul, not only for the thousands of lives it snuffed out. Even if the towers had been empty, the destruction of those buildings would have been heart-wrenching. Skyscrapers are the hallmark of civilization, monuments to human brilliance and creativity. I'm sure there are some nice trees, but I note that no one ever talks about the heavenly suburb. Philosopher Jacques Ellul said cities exhibit all the hopes of man for divinity. St. Augustine said the house of God is itself a city. It has become common wisdom that no one would rent property in a rebuilt World Trade Center. This is absurd. September 11th was a sucker punch. That trick doesn't work twice. We have the technology to make the building safe from incoming missiles. Moreover, by the time a new World Trade Center is built, Muslim fanatics will be about as threatening as Japanese kamikaze pilots. Who would have imagined after Pearl Harbor that the Japanese were governable? Yet Japan hasn't shown a disposition to fight in 60 years. Muslims feel humiliated now? We'll show them humiliated. Aesthetes complain that the buildings were ugly. Perhaps. But the important thing is, they were really big. Whatever goes up on that site ought to be even bigger than the buildings the savages destroyed. Erecting enormous skyscrapers to replace the twin towers limns the distinction between us and the barbarians. We can ride elevators a quarter mile into the sky and have a chocolate mousse. What can they do? Multi-millionaire Osama bin Laden lived in a cave and is now DED dead under a daisy cutter in Tora Bora. Here in America, ordinary Americans consider 70-story buildings mediocre. As Donald Rumsfeld said of Al-Qaeda, their specialty is destroying things they could never have built themselves using technologies they never could have developed themselves. The urge to destroy may not come from Islam, but creation is not Islam's strong suit either. In his seminal book, The Creators, historian Daniel Boorstin explains the Islamic approach to innovation. While Judaism and Christianity begin with the creation, Islam reveres a God who creates nothing. It is a central tenet of Islam that God did not even create the Quran. According to Boorstin, mullahs teach that since the speech of God is uncreate, the words must be eternal uncreate. The world comes into being not by God's energy and initiative, but by fiat, much like Supreme Court rulings. As Boorstin says, for a believing Muslim, to create is a rash and dangerous act. I guess that would explain why they don't have chairs. Mohammed Atta loathed skyscrapers. Newsweek reported that he viewed the emergence of tall buildings in Egypt as an odious surrender to Western values. The most fitting memorial to the victims of the World Trade Center attack is to build the world's most breathtaking skyscraper on top of Mohammed Atta's corpse. This whistleblower they like. June 13, 2002. In their enthusiasm to bash the Bush administration for its handling of the war, which Democrats consider an annoying distraction from the real business of government, which is redistributing income, the left has embraced FBI agent Colleen Rowley as a modern Joan of Arc. From liberal headquarters at the New York Times, Maureen Dowd fawns over Rowley, calling her the blunt Midwesterner who painted a stunning and gruesome portrait of just how far gone the Bureau is. Frank Rich calls her a forthright American woman. At least liberals seem to have gotten over their disdain for government whistleblowers. Back when the world's most famous whistleblower produced tapes proving the President of the United States had committed a slew of felonies, the left was somewhat muted in its enthusiasm for female truth-tellers. Dowd called Linda Tripp a witch with a boiling cauldron. Rich said Americans despise a snitch. Fortunately for Rowley, she is only a snitch against the FBI. One shudders to think what names liberals would be calling the unglamorous agent if she were testifying against Bill Clinton. Also, fortunately for Rowley, liberals aren't listening to her. It is striking how the media have studiously ignored Rowley's specific indictment of the FBI, preferring to prattle on about her raw courage in the abstract. Dowd exclaimed that Rowley painted a stunning and gruesome portrait of just how far gone the Bureau is. Okay, but what did she say exactly? Bewildering news accounts leave the impression that Rowley's act of dauntless valor was to fly to Washington to tell the Senate that the FBI has really old computers. In fact, the gravamen of Rowley's 13-page memo is essentially that FBI headquarters botched the Zacharias Moussaoui case by refusing to racially profile Muslims. Boiled to its essentials, Rowley's theory is that being a Muslim should constitute probable cause. Rowley condemned FBI brass for refusing to authorize a search warrant for Moussaoui based on the following information. 1. He refused to consent to a search of his computer. 2. He was in flight school. 3. He had overstayed his visa. And 4. He was a Muslim. Let's see, which of these factors constitutes probable cause? Refusal to consent to a search? It is your right to refuse. Any other rule would allow cops to bootstrap their way into a warrant. Hi, Zacharias, may we search your computer? No, that's suspicious. Grounds for a warrant. I don't think so. In flight school? No. Overstayed visa? No. Is a Muslim? Not allowed. As Rowley admits, reasonable minds may differ as to whether probable cause existed on the basis of the above facts. But, she says, once French intelligence confirmed Moussaoui's affiliation with radical fundamentalist Islamic groups, probable cause was certainly established. Not under the law, it wasn't. Being in league with known terrorists may be suspicious, but it is not probable cause to believe that a particular crime has been committed by a specific individual. Were the law otherwise, cops could get a warrant to search anyone who associates with the Clintons. Moreover, any Muslim who has attended a mosque in Europe, certainly in England, where Moussaoui lived, has affiliated with radical fundamentalist Islamic groups. A few months after the September 11th attack, 80% of British Muslims said they opposed the war in Afghanistan. The Muslim Council of Britain called for an immediate end to the war. A poll by the Daily Telegraph found that 98% of Muslims between the ages of 20 and 45 said they would not fight for Britain, but almost half said they would fight for Osama bin Laden. A Gallup poll taken in 9 Muslim nations last year found that only 18% of the people believed the yarn about Arabs flying planes into buildings on September 11th. Many subscribed to the Zionist plot theory. This was based on almost 10,000 face-to-face interviews in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, Indonesia, Turkey, Lebanon, Kuwait, Jordan, and Morocco. 77% said America's military action in Afghanistan was morally unjustified. Just to give you some idea how extreme that is, even liberals pretended to support the war with Afghanistan. In other words, if you associate with Muslims abroad, you are associating with Muslim fanatics. Rowley's position is that probable cause existed to search Moussaoui's computer because he was a Muslim who had lived abroad. I happen to agree with her, but liberals don't. So how did Rowley become the left's new Norma Rae? Given their nutty ideas, liberals should be applauding FBI headquarters for refusing to consider the fact that Moussaoui was a Muslim and condemning this incipient Mark Furman. Rowley is my hero, not theirs. FBI headquarters rebuffed Rowley's callous insensitivity to Muslims and denied a warrant request to search Moussaoui's computer, and thus failed to uncover the September 11th plot. The FBI allowed thousands of Americans to be slaughtered on the altar of political correctness. What more could liberals ask for? My name is Adolf. September 12, 2002. Among the patriotic lesson plans for 9/11 was one proposed by the National Council for Social Studies, which recommends a short story titled, My Name is Osama. Calculatedly inciting hatred toward white American boys, the story is about a nasty little boy, Todd, who taunts an Iraqi immigrant named Osama. Your mom is a raghead. He doesn't know my mother has a Ph.D. in pharmacology. She taught my pediatrician at Baghdad University. Todd says, your father forces your mother to wear a bag on her head. Your father must be a bully. My mother wears a hijab because she likes to. https://www.ncss.org/resources/moments/name-is-osama.shtml. This is the lesson to commemorate the biggest hate crime in history, committed by someone named Osama against people with names like Todd. Liberals are incapable of embarrassment. They're like Arabs without the fighting spirit. How about a 1942 lesson plan titled, My Name is Adolf? And while we're on the subject, might the 9/11 lesson plan inquire into what little Osama thinks about the terrorist attack? May we ask? Question from the actual lesson plan. Why, do you think, did Osama's family leave Iraq? Incorrect answer, because his father wanted to attend flight school in America. To be sure, there have been a number of hate crimes committed since 9/11, but they were committed by Muslims. Hisham Mohammed Hadayat murdered 2 and wounded many more at Los Angeles International Airport. Suleiman al-Faris, a.k.a. John Walker Lind, joined an attack in Afghanistan that left Michael Spann dead. Abdel Rahim, a.k.a. Richard Reed, tried but failed to murder a plane load of people on an American Airlines jet headed to Miami. Meanwhile, there has been precisely one confirmed hate crime committed in retaliation for the monstrous 9/11 attack. Some nut in Arizona murdered a Sikh thinking he was a Muslim. Current hate crime tally, Muslims, over 3,000 and counting, white guys, one. In the spirit of specifically targeting only the worrisome Muslims, I note that the media have inadvertently identified several of them with blinding clarity. In case you missed these stories, I bring them to your attention so you'll be forewarned. Do not fly with any of these kids. Soon after the terrorist attack, the New York Times chatted with students at the Al-Nur School, a private Islamic academy in Brooklyn, evidently the Arab equivalent of the Horace Mann High School, Anthony Lewis, 44. None of the students said they had experienced any harassment since September 11th. To the contrary, their school had been deluged with support from local Catholic schools, hospitals, state education officials, and political leaders. But the love was entirely one-sided. The students stated point-blank that they would not fight for America against a fellow Muslim. They denied that Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks. They criticized the United States for its cruel treatment of Muslims. "Isn't it ironic," one Islamic student sneered, "that the interests of America are always against what Muslims want?" That's why the last several major American interventions in Kuwait, Somalia, and the Balkans were all in defense of Muslims. Of course, there was the attack on Osama bin Laden, but according to them, he wasn't practicing true Islam. I wish they'd get their story straight. Do most Muslims support bin Laden or not? Though uniformly refusing to believe bin Laden was behind the terrorist attack, the students showed a remarkable lack of curiosity about who was behind it. Students from the Al-Nur School were interviewed again a few weeks later, this time by CBS's 60 Minutes. The students instantly and enthusiastically agreed with the proposition that a Muslim who becomes a suicide bomber goes to paradise for that action. One student answered definitely, and called a female suicide bomber very brave. Others said they earnestly hoped the suicide bombers went to paradise. "I mean, they're doing it for a good cause," one boy explained. "I pray that they go to paradise," another said. Most comforting, one student said, "I think we'd all probably do the same." Weeks later, at the urging of the principal, the students modified their answers. But according to CBS, none of them changed their view that suicide bombers in Israel would go to paradise. The Islamic studies teacher at Al-Nur claimed the students misunderstood true Islam. "If you go to chapter 4, verse 29, it says so clear, do not kill yourself." It's always so comforting when Muslims cite the precise verse from the Quran that tells them killing is wrong. Don't all empathic human beings understand instinctively that suicide and murder are wrong? What if they lost their Quran that day and couldn't remember the specific verse condemning murder? In any event, and more to the point, the Quran does not strictly inveigh against killing someone else for Allah. In the eye-opening book Unveiling Islam, Christian convert authors Ergun Mehmet Kanar and Emir Fethi Kanar say the Quran promises paradise to those who die in battle for Islam more certainly than it promises salvation to anyone else. Muhammad says, "Fighting is prescribed upon you. Tumult and oppression are worse than slaughter." The Quran instructs, "Fight those who believe not in Allah nor the last day, until they pay compensation with willing submission and feel themselves subdued." It promises, "If you are slain or die in the way of Allah, forgiveness and mercy from Allah are far better than all they could amass." Among the most famous victims of Islam's will to slaughter as practiced on 9/11 was a man named Todd, just like the nasty little boy in the social studies lesson. When Todd Beamer and the other passengers on United Airlines Flight 93 realized the Muslim hijackers were on a mission of death, they fought back. The real Todd did not shout, "God is great," before ripping out an innocent man's entrails. Todd Beamer prayed, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Beauty pageants can be murder. November 28, 2002. The religion of peace suffered another PR setback this week when Muslims in Nigeria welcomed the Miss World beauty pageant by slaughtering Christians in the street and burning churches to the ground. At last count, more than 200 people were dead, hundreds more were injured, and thousands were left without homes. Also, the Nigerian contestants' chances of winning Miss Congeniality were cruelly dashed. Leaping at the one chance they had to attract positive press to their pissant country and begin the process of dragging themselves out of the 13th century, Nigerian Muslims instead chose to hack innocent people to death in the name of Allah. Pageant officials pulled up stakes and immediately took the show to London. One assumes the director of the Nigerian Department of Tourism isn't pleased. Winning the pageant site had been an uphill battle from the beginning. Some of the more closed-minded Miss World participants were already carping about the upcoming stoning of a Nigerian woman in accordance with Islamic Sharia law. The president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, tried to downplay the Muslims' murderous rampage by cheerfully explaining, "The beauty queen should not feel that they are the cause of the violence. It could happen at any time irresponsible journalism is committed against Islam." Well, that's a relief. It seems an article in a Nigerian newspaper had mused that the Prophet Muhammad would probably have chosen a wife from among the Miss World contestants. This upset the practitioners of the religion of peace. And for good reason. Their polygamous prophet actually preferred his wives a little younger. One of Muhammad's wives was 6 years old. Muslims reacted to the article by bludgeoning, stabbing, and burning Christians to death. Some enforcers of the religion of peace in Nigeria ordered Muslims to kill the author of this blasphemy. Overheard at the Miss World contest, "Does this make me look fatwa?" As long as liberals are going to keep demanding that Americans refer to Islam as a religion of peace, it would be a big help if Muslims would stop killing people. The New York Times simply refuses to admit that their little darlings, angry, violent Muslims, could ever be at fault for killing people. That makes no sense because Islam is a religion of peace. The Times reviewed the facts of the slaughter during the Miss World contest, processed them through a PC prism, and came to the conclusion that Islam is peaceful, but religion causes violence. Thus, according to the Times headline, "Religious violence in Nigeria drives out Miss World event," it wasn't Muslims killing people, it was non-specific religious violence. The article explained that Muslims pouring out of mosques to kill Christians and torch churches in Nigeria resulted from the tinderbox of religious passions in the country. The police step in to try to quell rioting Muslims, and the Times reports this as fighting between Christians and Muslims. Ah, the cycle of violence. Religion causes violence, and never mind that the most bloodthirsty cult in the 20th century was an atheistic sect known as communism. It was not true communism. And Muslim terrorists are not practicing true Islam. Ironically, liberals would hate Muslims who practice true Islam. Without the terrorism, Muslims are just another group of anti-choice fanatics. Winning Best in Show was the Times' headline on an article about the Christian missionary shot dead in Lebanon by a Muslim. "Killing underscores enmity of evangelists and Muslims." This is like referring to the enmity between a woman and her rapist. She hates him, he hates her. It's a cycle of violence. Except the funny thing about the Christians is, they still love the Muslims. The Muslims' main beef with the Christians was, I quote, "Christians destroy the fighting spirit of the children, especially of the Palestinian youth, by teaching them not to fight the Jews, teaching the Palestinians to forgive the Jews and leave them Jerusalem." The Times seemed to agree the Muslims had a point with the evangelical, just as no new data can shake the Times' belief that Islam is a religion of peace. Nothing can disabuse them of the idea that Christians, as a general matter, deserve to be shot. In a news analysis, the Times said the missionaries claimed they were merely exposing people to Jesus Christ. But, the Times said in a j'accuse tone, a somewhat more direct goal emerges amid the website postings. The Times had caught the Christians red-handed committing irresponsible web postings against Islam. They were asking for it. On the bright side, at least this means the Times is holding the gun innocent in this one instance. Luckily for the Times, Christians do not rip out people's entrails in response to irresponsible journalism committed against Christianity. War-torn Democrats, January 29, 2003. Last week, Senator John Kerry gave a speech saying, "Mr. President, do not rush to war." Rush to war? We've been talking about this war for a year. It's been 3 months since Kerry duly recorded his vote in favor of a war resolution to forcibly remove Saddam Hussein from power. In 1991, Kerry voted against the Gulf War, saying the country was not yet ready for what it will witness and bear if we go to war. Having been taunted for that vote and that prediction ever since, this time Kerry made sure to vote in favor of war with Iraq. This will allow the New York Times to describe him as a moderate Democrat forevermore. Indeed, a surprisingly large number of Democrats voted for the war resolution last October. But as soon as the November elections were over, Democrats like Kerry began aggressively attacking the very war they had just voted for. These Democrats want to have it both ways. If the war goes well, a lot of them voted for war with Iraq, didn't they? But if the war does not go well, many of the very Democrats who voted for the war resolution will have emerged as leading spokesmen for the anti-war position. A vote for the war, surrounded by Neville Chamberlain foot-dragging, is a fraud. The Neville Chamberlain Democrats are now claiming they didn't realize what they were voting for. John Kerry says he thought a resolution authorizing the president to use force against Iraq meant that the United Nations would have to approve. Dianne Feinstein said she voted for the resolution, assuming it meant we would invade only if our allies approved. Joe Biden made the terrific argument that if we don't wait for UN approval, it would make a mockery of the efficacy of the UN. The Democrats appear to be the only people who still believe there is any efficacy to the UN. In any event, I believe the United Nations should be more worried about that consequence than we should. Kerry claims he is still four square behind disarming Saddam Hussein, but not until we have exhausted the remedies available, built legitimacy, and earned the consent of the American people, absent, of course, an imminent threat requiring urgent action. As George Bush pointed out in his State of the Union address, dictators are not in the habit of politely putting us on notice before they strike. By the time a threat is imminent, the Capitol will be gone. That's the short version. The long version of Kerry's position is this. If you have a breach that, by everybody's standard, at least in the United States, those of us in the House and Senate and the President join together and make a judgment, this is indeed a material breach. And then others, some of them can't be persuaded, if we have evidence sufficient to show the materiality of the breach, we should be able to do what Adlai Stevenson did on behalf of the administration, Kennedy administration, and sit in front of the Security Council and say, "Here is the evidence. It's time for all of you to put up. We need to all do this together." And that's what I think the resolution that was passed suggests. There's a call to arms to unite the Democrats. If there has been a material breach by everybody's standard, then and only then we can boldly go to the United Nations. This is the fundamental problem of the anti-war movement. They can't bring themselves to say it's a mistake to depose Saddam Hussein, and "don't hurry" is not much of a rallying cry. Why not hurry? Democrats claim they haven't seen proof yet that Saddam is a direct threat to the United States. For laughs, let's suppose they're right. In the naysayers' worst-case scenario, the United States would be acting precipitously to remove a ruthless dictator who tortures his own people, gassed the Kurds, and allows his sons to operate rape rooms. As Bush said after detailing some of Saddam Hussein's charming practices, if this is not evil, then evil has no meaning. It's not as if anyone is worried that through some horrible miscalculation, we could be removing the Iraqi Abraham Lincoln by mistake. Either we're removing a dictator who currently has plans to fund terrorism against American citizens, or, if Bush is completely wrong and Eleanor Clift is completely right, we are just removing a dictator who plans to terrorize a lot of people in the region, but not Americans specifically. Even for someone like me, who doesn't want America to be the world's policeman, the risk of precipitous action against Saddam Hussein doesn't keep me up at night. The Democrats' jejune claim that Saddam Hussein is not a threat to our security presupposes they would care if he were. Who are they kidding? Democrats adore threats to the United States. Bush got a raucous standing ovation at his State of the Union address when he announced that this year, for the first time, we are beginning to field a defense to protect this nation against ballistic missiles. The excitement was noticeably muted on the Democrat side of the aisle. The vast majority of Democrats remained firmly in their seats, sullen at the thought that America would be protected from incoming ballistic missiles. To paraphrase George Bush, if this is not treason, then treason has no meaning. Will of Allah preempts Iraq invasion, February 6, 2003. I knew the media were up to something with their wall-to-wall coverage of the Columbia space shuttle explosion. The full story is, shuttle disintegrated during re-entry, all astronauts killed, including some very remarkable people. Very sad. NASA picking up the debris to figure out what happened. It was a plane crash story. Only a lot more expensive. So why was the shuttle explosion being covered like the 9/11 attack? A quick review of the Treason Times laid bare the seditious objective. The shuttle presented a new argument for appeasement. Warning, great Satan, your money and technology and little gadgets cannot insulate you from disaster. The New York Times proclaimed, as Iraq war looms, a new sense of vulnerability. American hubris blunted again. Breathless news accounts of the shuttle blast were merely a more demure version of Islamic terrorists cheering in the street in reaction to the explosion. If the Times weren't afraid of violating the wall of separation, it would have run an editorial titled, "It Was the Will of Allah." The Times quoted a series of random Americans saying things like, "Now I'm hearing a lot of people say, if we go to war, we're going to endanger a lot more than seven lives." Another classic Times man on the street said that it reinforced his belief that we should find diplomatic solutions instead of threatening other countries with war. For 1 year, in a nation ablaze with war fever, I don't believe the Times has managed to interview a single person who supports war with Iraq. Their man on the street always seems to be standing on a street suspiciously close to Central Park West. The Gettysburg Address of liberal idiocy was a letter to the editor from a Jim Forbes of San Francisco 2 days after the crash. The Times titled his contribution to liberal think, "A Time of Mourning for Shattered Dreams, A Period of Healing." In full dress sanctimony, Forbes wrote, "The loss of the space shuttle Columbia and its crew of seven is a national tragedy. Time is needed for Americans to mourn. I hope that President Bush will do the right thing by slowing down his march to war and focusing instead on the healing that such a blow to national pride requires." Here was a pithy concentration of the multiple idiotic things liberals were saying about the space shuttle, the insincerity, the audacity, the smarminess. He even worked in the healing process. How Jim Forbes of San Francisco must have polished that little gem. The idea that liberals feel the shuttle explosion was a tragedy is patent nonsense. They were ecstatic at this new excuse to condemn the march to war. The nation is marching to war at such breakneck speed, it will be 2 years from 9/11 before we finally attack Iraq. Morose that their relentless naysaying is having no effect on the president's war plans, New York Times columnists are now positing imaginary scenarios in which war with Iraq leads to a stock market crash and brings the nation to the brink of nuclear war. Nicholas Kristof has gone the Maureen Dowd route of using the op-ed page of the Times for a dream sequence column. But instead of dreaming about Bush being retarded, as Dowd does, Kristof dreams of catastrophe for America. In Kristof's fantasy, Bush eventually apologizes to Secretary of State Colin Powell for invading Iraq. The strain of not having a Democrat in the Oval Office to lose wars for America is driving liberals to fevered fantasies of America's defeat somewhere in the world. In other appeasement news, former UN arms inspector Scott Ritter has completely vanished from the anti-war scene since news of his sex arrest broke. 3 weeks ago, it was revealed that Ritter was nabbed soliciting sex from underage girls on the internet in 2001. He was charged with attempted endangerment of a child, and the case was adjourned in contemplation of dismissal, with directions for him to stay out of trouble for 6 months. Until news of his sex arrest became public, the New York Times had been treating Ritter's reincarnation as a peacenik as the greatest act of patriotism since Nathan Hale told the British he regretted only that he had but one life to give for his country. It's now day 17 and counting of the Times' refusal to mention Ritter's arrest. As we go to press on the book, it's day 562 of the Times' refusal to mention Ritter's arrest. Though the peace movement lost Ritter, it seems to have picked up Jerry Springer. Perhaps Springer is hoping he can get Scott Ritter's wife on the show to confront Ritter and the underage girl. But Ritter was a freelance peacenik. At least the Times could count on stability and permanence from John Hartpence Carey. Poor Carey was just on the verge of figuring out whether he was for war with Iraq or against it when he was told he hadn't figured out his own last name. Carey was shocked to be told that, despite years of allowing himself to be passed off as an Irish Brahmin, both his paternal grandparents were Jewish and his real name is Cohn. When confronted with the news, Carey said there were signs he missed, such as his longtime, twice-requited desire to marry a rich Shiksa. Now Carey will need time for the healing process. We must halt the march to war. Kissing Cousins, New York Literati and Nazis, March 20, 2003. It became clear the nation was finally going to war with Iraq this week when the New York Times pulled 24 reporters off the Augusta National Golf Club story. On Monday, President Bush gave Saddam Hussein 48 hours to get out of Baghdad or the U.S. military would remove him forcibly. Many still held out hope that Saddam would abandon power without a fight, primarily so we could listen to liberals explain how a peaceful resolution was brought about by their urgent demands that we work through the United Nations and had nothing to do with the fact that Saddam was surrounded by 200,000 American troops. In response to Bush's ultimatum, Saddam's son, Uday Hussein, said Bush was stupid. He said Bush wanted to attack Iraq because of his family, and he said American boys would die. At least someone is finding the New York Times helpful these days. In angry harangues largely indistinguishable from the one by Uday Hussein, the Democrats were outraged at Bush. Senator Joe Lieberman, Democrat of Connecticut, spent 40 minutes detailing Saddam Hussein's manifest cruelties and violations of all human norms. Without breaking a sweat, Lieberman then said he could understand why the French were not bothered by these indisputable barbarisms. It was Bush's failure of diplomacy. Bush, the clod, had failed to convince the inconvincible. Senator Tom Daschle, Democrat of South Dakota, said, "I'm saddened that this president failed so miserably at diplomacy that we're now forced to war. Saddened that we have to give up one life, because this president couldn't create the kind of diplomatic effort that was so critical for our country." Mostly, the Democrats were saddened that America was about to win a war. With the nation on the verge of a glorious military triumph, liberals have had to put their predictions of a Vietnam quagmire on the back burner for a few weeks. Instead, they have turned with a vengeance to attacking American arrogance. The day after President Bush's speech, Washington Post columnist David Ignatius spoke of self-defeating American arrogance. The Post quoted a senior U.S. official, that's newspaper jargon for a janitor at the Pentagon who picked up the phone, warning of a degree of hubris unprecedented in American history. The New York Times' lead editorial the day after Bush's speech also bemoaned American hubris. One front-page article called Bush trigger-happy, and another bitterly accused him of breaking a campaign pledge to preside over a humble America. In the 19 months since the 9/11 attack, the Times has used the phrase American arrogance nearly as many times, 17, as in the entire 96 months of the Clinton presidency, 24. Instead of American arrogance, the Times yearns to return to Clintonian flatulence. There was no more eloquent testimony to what liberals mean by American arrogance than an article in the March 10th New Yorker, which nonchalantly quoted a Nazi in support of the proposition that Americans are jingoistic, imperialist rednecks. Amid page after gleeful page of European venom toward Americans, Columbia University professor Simon Schama quoted the anti-American bile of Norwegian writer and renowned Nazi sympathizer Knut Hamsun. Schama admiringly cited Hamsun's contempt for American patriotism, neglecting to mention that Hamsun went for Nazi patriotism in a big way. Beginning in the early 30s and until his death in 1952, Hamsun was absolutely smitten with Adolf Hitler. When the Nazis invaded Norway, Hamsun wrote a newspaper column saying, "Norwegians, throw down your rifles and go home again. The Germans are fighting for us all." He exchanged gifts and telegrams with Goebbels and Hitler. Indeed, so enamored of Joseph Goebbels was Hamsun that he gave Goebbels his Nobel Prize medal. Inconsolable upon news of the Führer's death, Hamsun was quoted in an obituary on Hitler saying, "I am not worthy to speak his name." He never equivocated, and he never apologized. Between issuing tributes to Hitler, Hamsun wrote the ironically titled book The Cultural Life of Modern America, which, as Professor Schama sniggeringly writes, was largely devoted to asserting its non-existence. Hamsun called America a strapping child monster whose runaway physical growth would never be matched by moral or cultural maturity. For cultural maturity, Hamsun turned to Nazi Germany. Hamsun hated America for all the same reasons liberals hate America. To the delight of New York sophisticates, Hamsun sneered at Americans who march in veterans' parades with tiny flags in their hats and brass medals on their chests, marching in step to the hundreds of penny whistles they are blowing. America's little patriotic parades apparently compared unfavorably to a stirring Nazi war rally. This is the essence of liberal admiration for Europeans and their pompous cultural snobbery. For proof that Americans are jingoistic hicks, they cite a Nazi. The Enemy Within, March 28, 2003. Just 5 days into the war in Iraq, the New York Times was optimistically reporting that despite a strong start, American troops had gotten bogged down. This came as a surprise to regular readers of the Times, who remembered that the Times thought we were bogged down from the moment the war began. The day after the first bombs were dropped on Baghdad, the New York Times ran a front-page article describing the mood of the nation thus. Some faced it with tears, others with contempt, none with gladness. Apparently, some people were gladdened. The stock market had its best week in 20 years. What people do with their money is a rather more profound barometer of public sentiment than any stupid poll. much less bold assertions by New York Times reporters. Times news stories are beginning to have the ring of Arab-style proclamations in defiance of the facts. As with Saddam Hussein, the truth for them has no meaning. They say whatever honor commands them to say. 5 days after the Treason Times was morosely reporting that no one viewed the war with gladness, things had gotten even worse. In a single editorial, the Times said our troops were faced with battlefield death, human error, and other tragedies. The task looks increasingly formidable. There were disturbing events, and American forces were engaged in a fierce firefight, an early glimpse of urban warfare. There were downsides, disheartening events, and grievous blows. We are losing this war. The elite Republican Guard is assembling outside New York City. Head for the hills. In fact, the fierce firefight referred to in the editorial concerned a battle in Nasiriyah, in which American troops took an entire city with 9 casualties. That's what most people call a triumphal bleep-kicking. CNN's favorite general, Wesley Clark, has also been heard to opine that our troops are getting bogged down in Iraq. His competence to judge American generals is questionable, inasmuch as his command was limited to NATO. We prefer to hear from American generals, thanks. When Clark was NATO commander in the Balkans, his contribution to international peace consisted of mistakenly bombing the Chinese embassy in Belgrade and ordering U.S. pilots to fly at such high altitudes that even the pilots complained they were being forced to incur unnecessary civilian casualties. On MSNBC, Forrest Sawyer compared Iraqi forces killing our troops to American revolutionaries and said the war was likely to turn into a nightmare. Liberals never quit. American forces have taken 2/3 of Iraq and are fast advancing on Baghdad. Saddam's lieutenants are so demoralized that they have turned to lashing out at the Jews. Saddam's vice despot, Tariq Aziz, says the war is being fought only to create something called Greater Israel. If the dictator business doesn't work out for him, at least Aziz is well positioned to run for Congress as a Democrat. Thousands of Iraqi soldiers have surrendered or disbanded. Thousands more have been captured, and still thousands more have been killed. Meanwhile, American forces have suffered fewer than 24 deaths. And if that's not enough to convince you the war is going splendidly, just look at the increasingly gloomy expression on Dan Rather's face. Most auspiciously, the Arab League has appealed to the United Nations Security Council to stop the war. One can only hope the Security Council will agree to intervene. I'd like to see them try to stop us. Would France threaten us with war? Young men across America would have to enlist as a matter of honor. The Army could use it as a recruiting slogan. Are you too chicken to fight the French? Even liberals would enlist as a way to pick up credit for military service with no risk of injury. Not surprisingly, the New York Times gave Saddam's recent speech more exultant coverage than they did Bush's State of the Union address. Since the first bomb hit Baghdad, everyone at the Times had been itching to use the word quagmire. Somewhat surprisingly, Saddam beat even Maureen Dowd to the punch. According to Saddam, the invading forces are in real trouble. The Times agrees. Liberals aren't afraid we'll do badly in Baghdad. They're afraid we'll do well. After the Arab television network Al Jazeera repeatedly ran footage of U.S. prisoners of war over the weekend, the New York Stock Exchange threw Al Jazeera reporters off the trading floor. This raises the question, when are they going to remove the Times reporters? At least Saddam wasn't at tailhook. April 17, 2003. Despite liberals' calm assurance that Iraq wasn't harboring terrorists, this week, Abul Abbas, mastermind of the 1985 Achille Lauro hijacking, was captured in Baghdad. This is the second time the United States has caught Abbas. The last time, the Europeans let him go. which may explain why liberals are so eager to have Europeans help with the war on terrorism. They've done such a bang-up job in the past. In 1985, Muslim terrorists hijacked the Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro and threatened to kill the passengers and crew unless 50 imprisoned Palestinians were released by Israel. The terrorists doused American and British women with gasoline and taunted them with matches. They forced passengers to hold live grenades. When their demands were not met, the terrorists shot a wheelchair-bound American, Leon Klinghoffer, and forced other passengers at gunpoint to throw him overboard in his wheelchair. Even as the Americans were preparing a rescue mission, the Italian and Egyptian governments made a deal with the terrorists, offering the release of the Palestinians and safe passage to Tunisia to end the ordeal. The Europeans were delighted with this masterful act of diplomacy. The Americans were not so pleased. So, Oliver North conceived of an operation to get the terrorists back. Contrary to Egyptian President Mubarak's assurances that the terrorists had already left Egypt, North found out the terrorists were still there. Working with Israeli intelligence, North ascertained the precise Egypt Air flight that would carry the terrorists out of Egypt, right down to the flight number. He devised a plan to intercept the plane, modeled on the military's interception of Yamamoto, mastermind of Pearl Harbor during World War II. President Reagan was briefed on the daring plan, along with copious warnings from timorous State Department officials that the Europeans might have their feelings bruised, America would look like a cowboy, and it would only strengthen the hardliners in Egypt. Asked if the operation should proceed, Reagan said, "Good God, they've murdered an American here. Let's get on with it." Admiral Frank Kelso, the officer in charge of America's 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, ordered his men to carry out the mission. In no time flat, Tomcat fighters had taken off from the U.S. aircraft carrier Saratoga. Guided by Hawkeyes, the Tomcats caught up with the Egypt Air flight. The fighters stealthily trailed their target in total darkness, their lights off, even in the cockpit. The American pilots flew so close to the Egypt Air flight, they used flashlights to read the plane's tail number. Then the Tomcats swooped in, surrounded the Egypt Air flight, and forced it to fly to a NATO base on Sicily controlled by the United States. The New York Post headline the next day was, "Got 'em." And then Abul Abbas was released by the Europeans and given safe haven in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, whom liberals have assured us was not harboring terrorists. Republicans keep catching terrorists, and liberals keep sending them back. If there is a parable of how liberals support the enemy, this is it. Admiral Kelso, whose men carried out the dauntless Egypt Air interception, was cashiered out of the Navy because of tailhook. Feminists don't care about Saddam Hussein and his rape rooms, but they were hopping mad at Admiral Kelso for strolling through the tailhook convention to say hello to his boys, among them the ones who captured Leon Klinghoffer's murderers. To jog the memory of the horror that was tailhook, Lieutenant Paula Coughlin, the officer who made the most lurid allegations, accused a black Marine of molesting her. But then she kept identifying different black males as the perpetrator. Liberals managed to put their concern for racist accusations against blacks on the back burner in this case. When liberals get going, the ironies never end. Though Admiral Kelso was cleared of any wrongdoing after an official Navy investigation, liberals still wanted him punished. Former Representative Patricia Schroeder, Democrat from Colorado, engaged in a hysterical witch hunt of Kelso, marching with her fellow termagants to the Senate to demand that their colleagues deny Kelso retirement with 4 stars. The New York Times editorialized against Kelso. After a lifetime of honorable service to his country, Admiral Kelso barely managed to retire with 4 stars in a 54-43 Senate vote. A majority of Democrats opposed Kelso, along with all the Republican women in the Senate: Kay Bailey Hutchison, Nancy Landon Kassebaum, and Arlen Specter. Had the Senate denied Kelso his retirement with 4 stars, this American hero would have received a pension of $67,000 per year, rather than the princely sum of $84,000 per year accorded a 4-star admiral. The left's relentless attacks on Oliver North hardly require elaboration. He was investigated, charged with crimes, indicted by Lawrence Walsh, and his Senate campaign was destroyed. Al Gore compared North's supporters to Down syndrome children. Now, Democrats are demanding that the Europeans be let into Iraq so they can release some more terrorists, while liberals do their part at home, carving up the colonels and admirals who capture the people who murder Americans. Liberals meet unexpected resistance. May 1, 2003. Though many had anticipated a cakewalk for the media in undermining the war on terrorism, instead liberals are caught in a quagmire of good news about the war. Predictions that liberals would have an easy time embarrassing President Bush have met unexpected resistance. They're still looking for the bad news they said was there. Experts believe the media's quagmire results from severely reduced troops. The left's current force is less than half the size of the coalition media that lost the Vietnam War. It's been a tough few weeks all around for the anti-war crowd. On Sunday, the London Telegraph reported that documents had been discovered in Baghdad linking Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden. Hussein and bin Laden had a working relationship as far back as 1998, based on their mutual hatred of America and Saudi Arabia. The Osama files showed that the Iraqis were working feverishly to establish a future relationship with bin Laden and to achieve a direct meeting with him. The meeting with Osama's envoy took place a few months before al-Qaeda bombed 2 American embassies in East Africa. As we go to print, it's day 4 of the New York Times' refusal to mention these documents. And as we go to print on the book, it's day 492 of the New York Times' refusal to mention these documents. Government documents have also been found in Iraq showing that a leading anti-war spokesman in Britain, Member of Parliament George Galloway, was in Saddam Hussein's pay. Galloway says the documents are forgeries and the Iraqis set him up. Scott Ritter, former UN arms inspector turned peacenik, erstwhile suspected pederast, immediately defended Galloway in a column in the London Guardian. With any luck, Tariq Aziz will now step in to defend Ritter. At least Tariq Aziz knows he lost the war. American liberals are still hoping for a late-inning rally. But the war was so successful, they don't have any arguments left. Liberals can't even sound busy. In their usual parody of patriotism, liberals are masters of the long-winded statement that amounts to nothing. They can't go on TV and say nothing, but all they can find to complain about are some broken figurines. Liberals said chemical weapons would be used against our troops. That didn't happen. They predicted huge civilian casualties. That didn't happen. They said Americans would turn against the war as our troops came home in body bags. That didn't happen. They warned of a mammoth terrorist attack in America if we invaded Iraq. That didn't happen. Just 2 weeks ago, they claimed American troops were caught in another Vietnam quagmire. That didn't happen. The only mishap liberals can carp about is that some figurines from an Iraqi museum were broken. A relief to college students everywhere who have ever been forced to gaze upon Mesopotamian pottery. We're not talking about Rodins here. So the Iraqis looted. Oh well, wars are messy. Liberalism is part of a religious disorder that demands a belief that life is controllable. At least we finally got liberals on the record against looting. It seems the looting in Iraq compared unfavorably with the rebellion in Los Angeles after the Rodney King verdict. When rebels in Los Angeles began looting, liberals said it was a sign of frustration. They were poor and hungry. As someone noted at the time, apparently they were thirsty too, since they hit a lot of liquor stores. At least the Iraqis were careful to target the precise source of their oppression. They looted Saddam's palace, official government buildings, and the French Cultural Center. However many precious pots were stolen, it has to be said, the Iraqi people behaved considerably better than the French. After Americans liberated Paris, thousands of Frenchmen were killed by other Frenchmen on allegations of collaboration with the Nazis. Subsequent scholarship has shown that charges of collaboration were often nothing more than a settling of personal grudges and family feuds, which was made easy by the fact that so many Frenchmen really did collaborate with the Nazis. The French didn't seem to resent the Nazi occupation very much. Nazi occupation is their default position. They began squirming only after Americans came in and imposed democracy on them. Despondent over the success of the war in Iraq, liberals tried to cheer themselves up with the politics of personal destruction, their second favorite hobby after defending Saddam Hussein. Responding to the question of whether the Supreme Court should hold sodomy to be a fundamental constitutional right, Republican Senator Rick Santorum made the indisputably true point that a general right to engage in consensual sex would logically include adultery, polygamy, and any number of sex acts prohibited by the states. For the limited purpose of attacking Santorum, liberals agreed to stipulate that adultery is bad.